It is time for the single coolest sports show in the country, The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics.
You've got Matt Bonner, who my notes tell me is a sandwich blogger named Red Mamba. I mean, how can you not like a guy like that?
And the Red Rocket knocks down the triple.
Red Rocket, I'm telling you, Red Mamba might not miss a shot.
Just like in politics, in the instructional video business, you need credibility.
You want credibility? I'll give you credibility. Hey, Tim, what's my nickname?
The Red Rocket.
No.
The Sandwich Hunter?
No. Fry Gun.
The Medium Fundamental?
This is The Life with Matt Bonner. I am Chris Ryan. If you're joining us for the show, I am in the great state of New Hampshire. Matt is in Texas. The segment of the show brought to you by the Loudoun Country Club. Closer than you think. Schedule a tea time at loudouncc.com. Joining us right now is Matt Bonner. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Awesome. Appreciate you joining us for the show. We got a great show today. We're going to go in-depth on the Celtics and Bruins. Obviously, the passing of John Havlicek. Sad moment in Boston sports. We'll hear from a couple of players, including Jaylen Brown, on the impact of Havlicek and also Danny Ainge as well. Bruins win a game 7 against the Leafs and also taking on the Columbus Blue Jackets right now. We'll start with the Celtics, though, and their victory over the Milwaukee Bucks, 112-90, game 1. And this is the most predictable thing of the Celtics season so far, but after being, shall we say, hesitant and not bullish on the Celtics' championship chances, one game into the conference semifinals, and I am back in, wondering if there's any room on board the bandwagon. The bandwagon was just driven by a couple folks, had a couple stragglers on it, but that bandwagon's getting pretty heavy right now. So I am bullish on the Celtics once again.
Yeah, I mean, if that trend of the first round series going into game one against the Bucks continues, for sure. They're the only team really in the whole league right now that's consistently playing defense. You look at the job they did in the first round, and now, you know, you look at this Bucks team who scored once to score 120-130 points, to hold them to what they did was pretty remarkable. And also, I thought the Celtics backcourt, Kyrie Irving, Jaylen Brown, just decimated the Bucks backcourt. You can really see how that Malcolm Brogdon injury is hurting the Bucks right now. They're just completely overpowered in the guard position.
Yeah, the key, you're absolutely right, on the defensive end for the Celtics. We talked about this on the show last week with Al Horford, and we'll hear more on it in the show this week. But the Celtics acknowledged and understood the need to get back in transition and do so on each and every possession and to force the Bucks into a half-court game. And that's where they feel they can have success. And the way that they defended Giannis Antetokounmpo with layers was great. The game plan for game one was great. But as you know, Coach Bud, Mike Budenholzer, is going to adjust, and we'll see what the Bucks do moving forward in the series. By no stretch is the series over, but the Celtics took a huge step forward, and they made the claim very clearly that they are here. They're here to contend for a championship. What took place during the regular season, guys going a different direction, that's all over. This team is going to compete as one on the defensive end and, you know, support and work with each other on the offensive end as well.
Yeah, this is what we've been talking about all season. We've been waiting for this team to come together. And if you remember, I stated that having that kind of easy first-round series, which I thought all four of the top seeds in the Eastern Conference would have just to kind of warm up to the playoffs, turned out to be a huge advantage because it really did solidify the Celtics team play, especially on the defensive end, and give them that cohesiveness they need to contest for a championship. That cohesiveness, I think all Celtics fans have been waiting to see all season, but for whatever reason, that chemistry just never came together. But now it's here. And you look at what they did to the Bucks on their home court while getting decimated on second chance points on top of it. I mean, they should have beat them by 30. They probably could have beat them by 30 something on their home court in game one. You know, obviously a huge game. Just really incredible start to the series for the Celtics.
Yeah, and just the way they're playing for each other now. And I think that, you know, there are a number of factors where the regular season guys, I think, are a little bit more, you know, looking for themselves and their points, particularly in, you know, the first three and a half quarters of a game. And there is a finality that exists with the postseason as well. And also the stats don't really matter in the postseason either. It's all about winning, and it becomes more, it becomes easier to come together as one. So those outside conditions, I thought, played a key role. And, you know, the Celtics have guys like Al Horford who just step up in the postseason as well, where Horford played an incredible game and showed why he is one of the elite bigs in the league. And Giannis, a great game plan against him. We know how challenging they are, and are going to be moving forward in this series, and that adjustments will be made. But huge credit to Brad as well. Celtics had a long time. They had a week to come up with a solid game plan, and they got you know, exactly that. Now, moving forward, you know, the Celtics shot the ball really well in that game. They got great contributions, as you referenced, from the backcourt. Also, a Gordon Hayward coming off the bench as well. And the Bucks missed a lot of open shots in that first game. And in terms of the first-round series, Indiana was perfect for the Celtics. You saw it really in Game 1, where the Celtics struggled out of the gate to adjust to, you know, the postseason intensity that the Pacers were bringing. And then they adjusted the second half and were off from there, really throughout the, you know, the first first round, and now onto this first game here against the Bucks. So in terms of adjustments, what do you expect Coach Bud to do? And how do the Bucks counteract this layered five-man approach that the Celtics are throwing at Giannis? Does Giannis need to continue to be aggressive? Does he need to facilitate more and allow for other guys to step up and hit shots? How do you approach that from the Bucks' perspective?
Well, if you're Giannis, he has to stay aggressive. That's what he's done all season long. And he can't really shoot, so it's not like he's a guy who can afford to settle for jump shots or shots outside the paint, because that's not his game. So he's definitely going to keep pushing the pace, keep attacking the paint, and then making the play from there. If the Celtics are going to take away the transition game, which, remember last week I said was like number one against the Bucks, take away the transition and slow the game down, which they did, and imposed their style of play, which was a huge advantage for the Celtics. If the Celtics are going to be able to execute that and make the Bucks go in the half court and then really pack the paint on Giannis and help and force him to pass the basketball, then those Bucks players have to be ready to be aggressive on offense and step up and make shots and make plays when he collapses the defense and kicks it out. If they can't do that, they're doomed.
Yeah, you're right, and that's why where Brogdon comes in as well. Brogdon is a really high percentage 3-point shooter, and his absence is significant. But Marcus Smart's absence is significant for the Celtics as well. Let's move around to some of the other series. We'll start with the Raptors and the Sixers. And Raptors, I think, have a clear advantage in this series because the Sixers are kind of where the Celtics are at. They have a tremendous amount of where the Celtics were, tremendous amount of talent, but the question is how well do they play together? And the Raptors play really well together, and we've talked about it before. I mean, I think Kawhi Leonard is arguably the best player in the NBA because of how he competes at both ends, and we saw that obviously in Game 1.
Yeah, and you knew Kawhi was going to step things up in the postseason. He gets the big picture of the process of what it takes to win a championship, and he kicks it into a new gear come playoff time when it counts. And that's what we've been seeing from him since these playoffs have started. If he's going to play like he did in Game 1 moving forward in this series, then for sure. I mean, how do you stop the Raptors and the Sixers?
True. Let's go out west. The Spurs obviously lose in Game 7 to the Nuggets. Really strong effort from the Spurs that series. It was impressed, obviously, with what we saw from the Spurs. And now the Nuggets move on to take on the Portland Trailblazers. Trailblazers, minus Jokic, are still, you know, a team to be a team to compete with. I obviously, you know, the shot from Damian Lillard was absolutely incredible to end that previous series against the Jazz. I look at them right now, and that's a team that's it's kind of scary.
Yeah, for sure, because he can take over a game at the drop of a dime. He can be 3 for 14 and then score 20 points in a quarter. And don't sleep on C.J. McCollum either. He's another pretty consistent scorer on the perimeter. The thing that to watch for me in that series is Denver has a lot of long, athletic perimeter defenders. So I'm wondering if over the course of a seven-game series, those guys can wear down that dangerous Trailblazers backcourt. And if they do, then I think, you know, in the other facets of the matchup, Denver has the advantage. So, you know, the Trailblazers are going to go as Damian Lillard and C.J. Yeah. McCollum go. So I think it's just a matter of if those Denver perimeter players can down.
Yeah, and when Nurkic went down, I mean, there was a question as to whether or not that was going to be kind of an end game for the Trailblazers. But with that dynamic backcourt, they have been able to excel even in his absence. Now on to the Warriors and the Rockets. Game one won by the Warriors. And we've kind of been waiting on what the Warriors are this year. Obviously, Cousins goes down, and they're a team like the Patriots, and you know, like we were wondering what was going to happen with the Celtics. That, in my view, once they're challenged, they're going to turn on they're going to flip the switch, and they're going to find what they need to win that series. They seem to give just enough, and we've seen that kind of throughout the course of this postseason. I mean, is there some concern with how they, you know, messed around with the Clippers, so to speak? Or do you feel that once, you know, they are challenged, no matter what the challenge is, they're going to be able to flip the switch?
Yeah, I don't know if it's so much flipping the switch as for them staying focused. I don't know if they're complacent for winning 3 of the last 4 NBA championships, or if they're losing interest. I mean, I don't think so, but it seems like they have lapses. You look at that first-round series against the Clippers. The Clippers had that record-breaking comeback to come back and get that win, and then the Warriors could have finished them off in 5, and again, they let the Clippers hang and end up winning that and force a Game 6 back in L.A. And the reason you don't mess around with teams, you put them away when you can, especially in the playoffs, is because that's another chance for injuries to happen. And if you recall going into Game 1 against the Rockets, Steph Curry and Klay Thompson were questionable because they got dinged up in that Game 6 against the Clippers, which really never should have even happened. Mm-hmm. So you can definitely roll the dice and end up shooting yourself in the foot when you mess around with teams. And then the other thing, you look at that Game 1 against the Rockets. The Rockets are on the road. They shot horrible, especially from the three-point line, especially James Harden. I mean, just terrible shooting percentages, and they still, you know, gave themselves or had a chance to potentially tie the game at the end. So if you're the Rockets, you got to feel somewhat confident moving forward in this series that you put forth such a poor shooting performance. You didn't execute like you normally do, and yet you still had a chance to tie or potentially win that game on the road.
Bruins, as we do the show here, get set to take on the Columbus Blue Jackets in Game 3 of their second-round playoff series after beating the Leafs in 7 games. Celtics looking good after Game 1 against the Milwaukee Bucks, and that begs the question of what could happen, where it didn't seem like going to the playoffs this year that the Bruins and the Celtics were necessarily going to be competing for championships. Really good teams, shot if things worked out, and the Celtics obviously have arrived in the postseason, and the Bruins have arrived too, but not only that, the Bruins have seen the path cleared for them with Tampa going out, the Capitals going out, the top seeds in the Western Conference going out. So the opportunity presents itself for all four teams to win a championship in the same season, the 2018-19 season.
The Grand Slam.
Which would be unbelievable. And has
never happened, right?
No. Never happened. And
that would be beyond unbelievable.
But it is not probable at this point, but is realistic for that all four teams could win a championship. At least make it to the finals. I mean, I wouldn't say that's probable either, but Matt, just doing that would be amazing in itself, but there is a chance that it could happen. Of course, it's been
that's bragging rights forever for the city of
right.
Boston.
That's it. Like, drive home safely. I mean, at this point, after all the championships that have been won, you wonder like what else can be accomplished. It was interesting prior to Game 7, a fan was sitting next to me, and they're announcing a couple fans sitting next to me, and they're announcing that the flag waver that night was an individual that has won three championships. And the guy's like, that could be just about anybody in any team in Boston. we like one of 10 Patriots or one of 10 Red Sox players. Who knows who that is? I thought that was pretty amusing. Red Sox, though, have struggled here. They're at 11-17. And now we're at the point of the season, Matt, where you're starting to get a little worried because this is a team that is finding ways to lose games just as they found ways to win games last year. On a day where they hit, there's no starting pitching. Starting pitching is good, they don't hit. Both starting pitching and hitting are good, they make a couple errors. Or the bullpen gives up a game. That has been the Red Sox season so far. And at 28 games into the year, it's not just the start. I mean, we're getting into the season here a little bit.
Yeah, it's like, all right, let's now. All right, starting now. It's just not happening for whatever reason. And it's frustrating for me around being down here in San Antonio because everybody knows I'm a huge Red Sox fan. So they're getting their shots in. They're getting their licks in for sure. Like, oh, what's up with the Red Sox? Oh, they look so good. Oh, So I'm waiting for them to turn it on and flip the switch. Let's do it now.
This is The Life with Matt Bonner. I am Chris Ryan. That segment of the show brought to you by the Latin Country Club. This is The Life with Matt Bonner. This segment of the show presented by Douglas Leonard and Garvey. If you've been injured, the most important decision you're going to make is who your lawyer is going to be. I encourage you to check out Douglas Leonard and Garvey at nhlawoffice.com. Celtics win game one of their opening round series against the Milwaukee Bucks in Milwaukee in blowout fashion, 112-90. Celtics were dominant defensively. Giannis Antetokounmpo scored 22 points but struggled shooting from the field as the Celtics hit him with a layered approach. It was Kyrie Irving with 26 points, 11 assists, and 7 rebounds for the Seas.
It's our job to go out there and execute. We obviously try to get the best out of each other, and I think that communication on the bench has improved vastly since the playoffs have started. And just everyone feels good, so I think that helps as well.
Al Horford says they came ready to play. He had 20 points and 11 boards.
We came in very focused, locked in on the things that we wanted to do as a group. We knew that we were going to have to play a very solid game, and I felt like our focus level was good from the beginning. We just continue to stick together.
Celtics had a week to prepare for their game against the Bucks to open this series, and it showed. The Celtics' preparation was tremendous. They met Giannis with layers. They were able to get back in transition D and had a solid game plan on both ends. Here's Brad Stevens from earlier this week at practice.
They have a ton of depth. They play differently, really, really well spaced around Giannis and Bledsoe and their drivers. Makes it really tough with all the shooting they have, both in their starting lineup and off the bench.
Do you feel you have to control tempo in this series? Do you guys have to play at your pace?
The pace is the next right play, and so there's going to be times to be opportunistic in transition. There's going to be times where you have to pull it out and decide that you need to search for a better shot, but you cannot play haphazard. Because haphazard possessions, turnovers, we turned it over too much against Indiana, and bad decisions at the rim when you get blocked lead to points on the other end, and they happen quickly and in less steps than the rest of us can achieve.
Terry Rozier stressed the same thing in regards to the Celtics' transition defense.
Do you feel the need to force them into a half-court game and try to slow them down?
Definitely. We know they're very effective when they run in and get out in transition, so trying to make them play against our set defense and load up, like I said, make it tough. When Giannis get that ball and push and he make it tough on defense. So we got to load up and make him see bodies and make it tough on him.
Celtics organization dealing with the loss of one of their all-time greats and number 17, John Havlicek. And this was something that was addressed by the team at practice on Friday. We'll start by hearing a couple of questions I was able to ask Danny Ainge.
How much of a debt of gratitude does this generation of players and your generation owe Havlicek based upon, you know, how he played and set that example, but also how he popularized the game?
Well, he was obviously a very good player and played a lot of minutes. I was reading somewhere on Twitter, someone said he played an entire season, like averaged like 46 minutes a game, and then only missed 2 minutes in 11 games in the playoffs. And I mean, that durability. That whole generation, that whole Celtics organization that won all those championships, they've set a great standard for the rising generation.
Did he have the type of skill set that would allow for him to cross generations and have success and be a superstar in any form of the league?
Oh yeah, John Havlicek. I think all the players that, and Jerry West of that era, I mean, those guys would have made it because they would have found a way. I mean, he wasn't a great long range shooter, but that was just because the game was different then. I think he would have figured that out.
Also talked with Brad Stevens about Havlicek's legacy.
I think we all try to live up again to the responsibility of the uniform and what it means to the city and what it means to the region, and trying to play the right way, prepare the right way, be a good teammate. But I think again, the basketball stuff's basketball stuff. The legacy that he leaves is a lot bigger than that.
How much of a debt of gratitude is owed to him and to players of that generation for what they, you know, went through, obviously, and what they established, both in terms of playing the game and how they popularized it?
No, I mean, I think that there's no doubt. I mean, I think the Celtics in general played a large role in that, obviously, with all the success, all the players, all the accolades, the greatest winner in Russell of all time, and probably a bunch of guys that are right next to him on that list. And so, like, again, it's pretty special to get a chance to put this uniform on.
Celtics have a number of players who are great students of the game. Kyrie is one. Jaylen Brown is another.
As a student of the game, how would you define John Havlicek's impact on this organization and on basketball as a whole?
Truly will be missed, man. He's a legend. You know, coming off the bench, you know, everything he's done with the Celtics organization. Someone that is truly special to the Boston Celtics, and his effect, you know, in losing and passing away is saddening, you know, saddening for everybody.
When you contact with him today?
No, I've never met him or talked to him, but, you know, his name rings bells. You know, we know who he is. We know what he's done for his organization. He's one of those legends that you aspire to be, so being a Boston Celtic. Truly sorry to hear that he passed away yesterday.
When you were coming off the bench earlier in the year, did you look to him as an example of being, you know, a star player that filled that role?
Definitely tried to tap into some of his energy, you know, just coming off the bench and having that energy, that aggression that he played with, you know, tried to carry that as well, and trying to use some of his leftover energy and use it for my benefit.
What is the need in your view to keep this kind of a half-court game? Do you feel like you can score with them, or do you need to rein them in the half-court?
We just got to play basketball. You know, at the end of the day, when the ball gets rolled out, we got a game plan. They have a game plan. We got to execute. You know, we know Giannis is a transition nightmare. We want to limit that. But at the same time, we got to come out and play basketball.
What has been your particular focus in closing games down the stretch here in the postseason?
Just being locked in, being aggressive, rebounding, just trying to make it, whoever I'm guarding, make it extremely tough for them. Rebounding and just executing in the final minutes and being aggressive, you know, just being myself.
That is Jaylen Brown. We switch gears to Bruins playoff coverage now, and Charlie Coyle has been one of the best Bruins so far this postseason. He had the goal that tied it and the goal that won it in Game 1 of their series against the Columbus Blue Jackets. That series now tied at a game apiece after Columbus won in double overtime. Game 3 Tuesday in Columbus at 7 p.m. Charlie Coyle hails from South Weymouth, Massachusetts.
How would you define this town's relationship with its hockey team? I was with the Red Sox, and Patriots have won a lot of championships, but there seems to be something special about the Bruins and Boston.
It's a hockey city, it is. It's a big sports city. You know, we love our path. Sox, Celtics, and everyone's had some success, you know, little or a lot over however many years, and this town's had a lot of championships, and you know, obviously we want to add to that, and I know the fans are on board with that and really want that too, and we're trying to make it happen for them, and you know, they do a lot for us, and just the support and how passionate they are. So you want to, when you have fans like that, you want to make them proud and give them what they want.
How awesome and rare is it, you know, to accomplish what you accomplished, and how do you kind of contextualize that in a game one where you dream of doing exactly what you did, I'm sure, you scoring an overtime winner, scoring the goal to tie it, and then doing it. What is it, how do you kind of conceptualize that and then see it come to reality?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think I'm pretty good at kind of staying kind of calm and level-headed, and just so it's, you know, you take it and you enjoy it, but it's, you move on from it too, you know, it's, that's one game, and it doesn't make anything, you know, it is nice, and it's nice to help contribute to my team and do it in that fashion, you know. I'm just at the end of some pretty passes, you know, Johansson, Heinen, all those guys who, I mean, made those plays before, I mean, they deserve much credit, you know, as I'm getting right now. So it's, that's why it's such a team game, and guys doing the little things and not caring who's getting the credit, that's what's huge. But you know, you definitely enjoy it. You know, like you said, you grew up kind of going over those scenarios in your head and doing that, and it's, yeah, I guess to do it now, it's kind of fun looking back and seeing where you were once and where you are now. But I had a lot of help and support that's kind of got me here, and my teammates who have helped make that come to fruition, I guess.
And it's not just that. I mean, you're second in goals in the postseason with 5, and you've been consistently one of the best forwards on this team throughout the course of the playoffs, too. And when you came in, did you feel, you know, added pressure to perform, given the fact you're coming into a home environment? And what does that mean in terms of what you've been able to accomplish so far?
Yeah, well, I think when I was even getting drafted, and you're like, I wonder if I'm getting drafted by the Bruins, hometown, and you know, I've talked to a lot of people who are like, you want to kind of get away from it. You don't want that added pressure. It's a lot. But I think spending, you know, 6-7 years in the league now and kind of being a little more mature, it's a little easier to come here and do that. And there's not as much pressure as I think others have thought there would be. So I'm kind of taking it in stride. But I, you know, whether the points come, you know, obviously they didn't come right away. But sometimes you're doing the right things and you're not on the score sheet, but you're still playing well. And sometimes you're scoring and you're not playing that well. So it's hard to read when you're just looking at the stat sheet. It always doesn't tell the whole story. I'm just trying to play my game and do as best I can doing that. And if it goes off my stick at the end, that's great. Not, you know, as long as we win, that's the main thing.
Final thing, Chara, Bergeron, Krejci, and Marchand have obviously a huge, you know, significance to this organization and throughout the league. How are they in terms of leadership within the room as compared to what you know, thought they would be? And how do they balance each other to create a climate?
Well, you hear a lot of stories before, and, you know, you ask around and how it is, and then you come here and experience it, and it's right on. It's they're the real deal, and it's, you know, just how they welcome newcomers and younger guys and make them feel comfortable. And I mean, that's what it's about, you know. You can be hard on some guys when need be, but it's, you want everyone to feel comfortable and make sure they can play at the top of their game, and those guys do that. And just the talk that they have, and you know, it's not just one guy saying something, it's they each kind of have their own, do their own little part and make sure it's, and they each bring their own type of leadership, but they do it together as a whole as well. And I mean, they've done it for so many years now that it's just so easy for them now to do it. And we're lucky to have guys like them who have been there and have experience and still do that. You learn from these guys every day. I know I have.
Charlie Coyle right there. Before the Bruins could start their series, the Columbus Blue Jackets, they had an item of business to take care of against the Toronto Maple Leafs. They went to Toronto trailing 3-2, won up there, came back home, and beat the Maple Leafs 5-1 in Game 7 inside TD Garden. After that contest, I talked with Patrice Bergeron.
Bergie, just the emotion of winning this Game 7, what do you see as the keys?
Well, I thought, you know, we stayed patient. You know, obviously getting the lead was huge. You know, you can never get away from that. But, you know, I thought they came back and they gave us a push, and we stayed composed and did the right things, and I thought we took care of the puck most of the night, and then we bounced. You know, obviously that third goal was huge by Sean, but yeah, I thought we composed and focused all night, and you know, talking about a lot about details, I thought tonight was a game of details, and we got it done.
What does it say about the group to win the series the way that you guys did? Obviously, going on the road to win Game 6, and then here, does that mean something in your view moving forward?
Well, I think, you know, we've been there before. I think a lot of guys have we've tried to rely on their experience, try to share that with the other guys. Also, that, you know, most of the young guys were with us last year and lived it also. So yeah, I think it's definitely a great character win for us tonight against a really good team, like I said.
Joachim Nordstrom was able to sneak the puck in between the post and Frederik Andersen to get the Bruins on the board and up 1-0 late in the first.
From the outside, you'd expect, obviously, the Marchand, Bergeron, and line, and obviously the other lines to have great success offensively. From your perspective, did your line come into this game expecting to have the type of impact that you had, and if you created opportunities, you'd be able to capitalize?
I mean, you never before a game, I would never say that you're not looking to score. And I think the key for us as a line is to play with the puck and play below the goal line. I think that's one of our biggest strengths as a line. Trying to you know, play a simple game. We were talking before the game, just throwing pucks at net, hoping for that the second opportunities.
And indeed, they did just that. Nordstrom with the first goal, and then it was Sean Corrali with the third goal, which put the Bruins firmly in the driver's seat. This is The Life with Matt Bonner. This is The Life with Matt Bonner. I am Chris Ryan. This segment of the show brought to you by the Prescription Center, where the health of you and your family comes first. More information, visit prescription-center.com. It's been a tough start for the Boston Red Sox, 11-17 at this point in the year after losing 2-2 the Tampa Bay Rays this weekend. Conversely, the Rays, the best in baseball, 18-9. Red Sox 7.5 games behind the Rays at this point in time. I talked with Red Sox starter Rick Porcello about his and collectively the starting pitching's difficult start to this year.
Just what do you like about the way you've been throwing as of late? Do you feel like you've been making steady progress to getting back to where you want to be?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is we won the last two games. That's what I like about it. Still got a lot of work in front of me to get to where I want to be, but definitely the last two have been positive, and got to, you know, keep building off those. But the most important thing is the fact that I'm able to go out there and give us a chance to win, which I wasn't able to do my first three starts. So that's the first and foremost.
That seems to be driving the staff, and Chris talks about that a lot too. He doesn't care necessarily what the results are, wants to see improvement, but putting a team in a chance to win, going deep into games. And how much of that competitive aspect do you think drives each one of these, the pitchers on the staff, that kind of pursuit of perfection, but also putting your team in a chance to win?
Well, I think, you know, the pursuit of perfection, it's more, we started off really, really bad. Mm-hmm. And we were all screwed up, all of us. So, you know, maybe except for DP, but it's not so much pursuit of perfection. We need to get back on track to help us win games. And then baseball is an imperfect game. It's an imperfect sport. So you go out there and, yeah, you want to be perfect, but very rarely does that ever happen. And that's why it's really important that our focus has to be on winning ball games and doing what we need to do each and every night to win ball games. Because you do that, you control situations that you're in, you limit big damage situations, and you give what we have is an incredible lineup. You give our guys a chance to, you know, keep the game close and go to work. So that's the most important thing. That's what should drive all of us, is winning ball games each and every night.
Yeah, even when you're on, though, you are always trying to obviously get a little bit better and to get to, you know, that point. And as you referenced, it's impossible to get to perfection in just about everything in life, but that always seems to drive you. But as you mentioned, it's kind of been a step back where everyone is just trying to get to the point where they're doing their role and allowing for this team, creating that base where this team can build off of your starts to have success.
Yeah, I think they go hand in hand. Okay. I mean, you know, you look to continue to get better because the other team is trying to get better, and they're all watching you. Hitters are preparing to face you once every 5 days, and they're ready for anything that you're going to bring at them. So we need to continue to sharpen things up so we can execute pitches in tough situations and be spot on when we're, you know, trying to attack locations. And that goes to helping us win ball games. So it all just kind of formulates together. But when you're out there in competition and you're on the field and you're not worried about you're not worried about looking up at the radar gun, you're not worried about how nasty your breaking ball is, and you're going out there just to pitch to win, it takes care of a lot of things too.
We've talked about this before, that you're one of my favorite pitchers to watch because of all the weapons in your arsenal. When there is a start like you had, is there an effort to simplify the amount of weapons that you use and say, okay, I'm just going to try to get these, you know, couple pitches right and then build a base off of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's, you know, it's a great way to put it, and that's pretty much exactly what I've tried to do. I think start out the season thinking you're in mid-season form, trying to attack guys with certain sequences that I flat out is just not prepared to execute yet. And, you know, that's just whatever rut I was in mechanically wasn't allowing me to do that. But being able to simplify and get back to just attacking guys, getting ahead in the count, limiting walks, those things that, you know, you're basically taught when you first start pitching all the way up, those little basic things are sometimes overlooked and sometimes are the most important parts. So that's kind of exactly what I did, and you know, keep going off of that, you know, start. So
finally, I mean, Chris talked about after his start here on opening day about never being as lost as he had been on a pitcher's mound before. What is that like for you guys? Can kind of bring it inside your heads from, so fans can kind of understand, you know, what it's like when you have outings like that and where you're not used to not having success and you want to have the success. And obviously there's the time in between starts where you have obviously opportunity to build and work, but also those thoughts are still with you.
Yeah, it's never a position that you want to be in, but inevitably, you know, you pitch long enough, you're going to be in that spot one way, you know, at one point or another. That's kind of what separates the men from the boys. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where mental toughness and focusing and knowing who you are and your foundation of who you are as a pitcher, that's where you got to get back to as quickly as possible. And it's always the hardest time to do it when things aren't going your way, when you're a little screwed up, you know, physically or mentally, or, you know, I think a lot of things, you know, you got so many different thoughts running through your head. There's so many different things that you know you need to do to pitch a good ball game and help your team win, that it really basically blocks you from doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to have that confidence and that reassurance in yourself so you can slow your mind down and go out there and execute pitches like you've always done. And like I said, sometimes that's the hardest part. Sometimes it's, you know, that mental game. It starts as a physical thing and turns into a mental thing. And that's what separates guys that last in the big leagues and pitch for 10, 15 years and guys that don't last. So
do you prepare for that? I mean, can an elite pitcher prepare for, you know, what's going to happen? Because you mentioned every pitcher it happens to. It happened to Pedro Martinez. It happens to everybody, except for maybe Justin Verlander, where you hit that wall at some point where you're not throwing 97, 98 and you used to, or your breaking ball doesn't have the break that it once did, and you have to, you know, figure things out. I mean, do you prepare for that during the course of your career?
Prepare through it for experience. I mean, Verlander went through the same thing. I was there when he was going through it. He had about 2 years where his fastball wasn't there and he was struggling, and he got it back. You can't prepare for the feeling of not throwing the ball the way you have your entire life, or whatever it is when you get into a, you know, a physical mechanical funk, or, you know, your velo drops for whatever reason for a certain period of time or things like that. You know, you start to think like, why is this happening?
Right.
I've always just done this naturally my entire life. Now I can't do what I've always done. And I think it's hard to anticipate what that's going to feel like. For me, the preparation has been, you know, I've had so many peaks and valleys throughout my career. Like, I've been through this a lot now, and it's just about focusing on these little things and keeping it simple and getting back to, you know, restoring your confidence and being aggressive and just executing these little simple things. And you want it all back at once, and it's really hard to get all back at once. So the simple approach and keeping things kind of just right in front of you and keeping your blinders on and just focusing on those little tasks each and every day, each start, that's how you slowly kind of get out of these funks, at least for me. Some guys can do it
quicker. I've been able to do it quickly in the past, or at times it's taken me longer, and it's really hard to put a finger on it, but the focus and the mental toughness and grinding it out each and every day and working on the right things is that's what's always kind of helped me, and I've just, I think, been prepared because I've experienced these failures and these struggles before.
Rick Porcello right there. Again, conversely, Tampa, they have seen great pitching so far this year as Tyler Glasnow, who came over in the trade for Chris Archer, has been phenomenal. He is 5-0 this year, 25 years of age, and out-dueled Chris Sale on Sunday.
The Rays have always been so adept at changing over their roster, and your trade looks to be an example of one of those where you bring in a high-end talent in exchange for a high-end talent that you have control over for a long period of time. When you look at the Rays, what do you see as the reason as to this team, you know, leading the division and kind of continually being successful?
I truly think it all starts in the clubhouse. I just think if you can get 25 guys who all get along and are very comfortable in what they're doing, I think that translates to just like your ability to have fun is a lot, I don't know, higher than if you were to just be uncomfortable. So I think they've really embraced the just come out, have fun. There's not really any of like the service time kind of unwritten rule stuff. And I think that really helps a lot of young guys come up and just feel comfortable.
Yeah, I think that's another piece is innovation. The different thinking about how a major league clubhouse works and also an embrace of new technologies in regards to, you know, obviously the different metrics and data. Is that a big thing for you? And do you think that's helped you?
Yeah, that's a huge part. I think just, I don't know, I guess the way I am, I tend to gravitate towards like the technology and like finding answers in that and also finding answers on the field. I think for me, my ability to make adjustments and my ability to learn from what I was doing through technology it's easier to figure out how to make adjustments, I think, with the technology and the numbers on paper as opposed to just kind of taking wild guesses.
Has that been as much as what's clicked for you as kind of the on the field side of things?
The biggest thing on the field has just been confidence and mentality. It's just been going out and like literally thinking of nothing and just going out and competing. I think like the 4 days in between your start, that's when I can dive in and really work and be in that process mentality. But once I go out into the game on that fifth day, I have to just separate all of that. And I think that's the biggest thing, just really going out and being confident.
I've had a lot of conversations with pitchers. Cole Hamels is one of the best ones about intellectuals and pitching and how challenging that can be because pitching is about doing the same thing over and over again on your start day, but experimentation can exist off of that start day. So how do you balance those two things of the consistency side but also the, you know, being curious?
I think they're both, you can kind of feed off both of them. I would say like with me, I've always been more of a, like, I just overthink a lot of stuff. And I really like the numbers. I really like learning about pitching and just, especially with all the new age stuff, I like being at the, just finding out all like the new stuff. And Kyle's like that. Our friend office is like that. So it's a really good relationship. But like I said, I think you need to forget about like all of that. For me anyway, the day I pitch, it's more of like I have my game plan, I've done my preparation, now it's time to turn off the process mindset and turn on the competition mindset. So, and then after the start, take a little bit and then go back to figuring out what you need to figure out.
How often do you experiment with grips? Because you, like, when you see a fastball grip, a slider grip, like kids will pick up a ball, make, okay, this is how I do it. But, you know, part of being, you know, curious as well is like saying, well, I'm going to throw it with this particular grip and see how it works. Do you find yourself experimenting using different types of grips?
So I've never really been a big, I've always had grips that work for me. And I think my biggest problem, especially younger, was like how to control and put my body in an optimal position to throw that pitch. So I think it's, you need to fix one thing before you can fix the next thing. But with the new technology and with the Edutronic cameras and with the spin rate and the spin axis, all that stuff, you're able to now like maybe play around with a grip and see it quicker. Like you actually get to see your answers right after you throw it. I can throw a pitch, look at the Edutronic camera, look at the spin rate, look at the axis, and see if that is a good grip as opposed to just like feeling it and just guessing like, oh, that seemed good, that looked good. So I think in today's baseball now, the more people can embrace that like quick feedback adjustment stuff, it's just everyone's gonna, I think, get better faster.
Finally, the Red Sox this year have talked a lot about the fact that they have a kind of a target on their backs and so forth. Do you feel that as a baseball player, or you know, when you're going out to make your start, you only get, you know, 30, 35 starts a year. Does it matter who you're facing against?
In terms of how
zeroed in you are, so
yeah, far. I think, I mean, there's a human element in everything. Like, I could say no, I could say yeah, but like, I think you are always going to feel like a little different. But like, I think what we talked about before, like, as long as you prepare the way you know how you should prepare, and it really doesn't make a difference. I think if you feel prepared, you're able to go and compete to the best of your ability, as opposed to if you are not prepared, then other factors can come in and maybe disrupt that. But my biggest thing is I'm trying to bring the same mentality into every start.
Glasnow has a 1.75 ERA. Thanks so much for joining us for The Life with Matt Bonner, that segment of the show brought to you by the Prescription Center.